In this episode, we wade out there with Anthony Janka from Arizona. Anthony began fly fishing to help connect with nature and pursue the love of fishing he gained as a youth. He immediately fell in love with the sport and exploring the mountains of Arizona for trout with his friends. We discuss fly fishing in Arizona, backpacking the Eastern Sierras, and Anthony shares some memorable stories of catching some very special fish. Welcome to the Wade Out There Fly Fishing Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Shemchuk. At Wade Out There, we believe fly fishing is special, but not elite, and that anyone can become a great fly fisher if they are willing to go, learn, and teach. Join me as I talk with other fly fishermen and women about their unique journeys into fly fishing, the rivers they fish, and the tactics and philosophies they practice. For those who can never leave the river in their hearts, this podcast is dedicated to helping you make the memories that keep us all coming back to Wade Out There. Welcome, Anthony. Thanks for being on the Wade Out There podcast. Pleasure to talk to you today, and I'm really looking forward to learning a little bit about Arizona and backpacking in the Sierras and all that you have to share about your trip and your journey in fly fishing.
Awesome, Jason. Yeah, man, me too. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, yeah, my pleasure, man. I spent some time in Arizona. I spent some time backpacking in the mountains, but the only time I spent backpacking in Arizona, I had to pack water in. So I think that you've done a better job of enjoying the backpack experience in Arizona than I did when I lived there. I didn't do much fly fishing when I was in Arizona.
Which is unfortunate.
I don't know if I regret it, but maybe I do a little bit. I don't try not to have regrets, but yeah, I wish I would have done a little bit, especially when I talk to people like you that have experienced such a great fishery out there. Can you talk a little bit how you ended up in Arizona and fly fishing, or were you in fly fishing before you got to Arizona, or how'd that work out?
Yeah, dude. So I've been in Arizona now most of my life, you know, going on like 35 years. So I was originally born in California. I was only there till about 4, moved out to Arizona. So I'm basically a native. I've been fly fishing since like 2015. It was the strangest thing. You know, I started watching YouTube videos, which I didn't really get into until recently. And I kept seeing people fly fish and I'm like, oh, that's kind of cool. And it's always something that I'd been interested in. And one day, man, I just went down to Sportsman's Warehouse, zero research, and I bought a cheap fly reel. I bought a Lefty Cray TFO 9'5" weight and bought some line. And I just went out and started doing it.
Where'd you start? Because you're in Arizona. Is there water close by to where you live? Or where in Arizona are you at the time?
There is. So I was in Gilbert. I'm still in Gilbert, which is like right outside of Phoenix. So okay. it's just in the East Valley is what they call it. Like Phoenix is just one huge with a bunch of suburbs. It would have been smart for me to go to like a local pond or like maybe the Salt River. But my first ever fly fishing experience was actually at Chevelon Canyon Lake up on the rim, which is an annoyingly tough place to fish, especially in the creek. If you go fish Chevy Creek, that is such a tough spot for even somebody who knows what they're doing. So I went there and I slapped the water pretty good for 3 days and it was terrible. It was a lot of fun though. I had a great time. I just didn't catch one fish.
What made it fun for you if you weren't catching fish? Because typically if you can have fun fly fishing and not catch fish, it's a good chance you're going to stick with it. So what made it fun for you?
Dude, ever since I started fly fishing, and even just in general before I started fly fishing, you know, it's not, for me personally, it's not all about catching fish. Like I could go out and wander around in the woods, hike a creek 5, 8, 10 miles, which we sometimes do in a day here. And I could be perfectly content, man, just listening to the wind blow and looking at the trees. So it's just, you know, don't get me wrong. Catching fish is amazing. I love catching small fish, big fish, dry flies, streamers, whatever. But for me, it's just about the adventure and the experience and just, you know, getting away from all the people and, you know, life and just getting out into nature.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of people can relate to that for sure. And I want to talk about one of those adventures specifically in a little bit. I know because you went into the Sierras on one of those adventures, but I thought we'd talk a little bit first about your your more local or home waters in Arizona? Because I don't know, I think part of the reason why I didn't go fly fishing when I lived in Arizona, other than I was super busy trying to learn how to fly, fly an A-10, but is I just, it's Arizona, man. Where's the water? Like I said, right? I was hiking around. There's no water. I was literally carrying a jug of water on this trip, multiple, right?
Yeah.
So I just, in my brain, and I think I'm certainly guilty of this throughout my life, but especially when I'm in a place like Arizona, there's no water. Not only is there no trout, there's no water. That's what's in my brain. Like there's no trout, there's no water. I'm busy. So I think it's cool that you dispelled that myth for yourself and started this adventure. But, why are the waters around Arizona special for you?
Dude, it's probably because, I've been fishing here since I was a kid. And typically, when I was a kid, we'd always go to the same spots. We'd go up to Woods Canyon Lake on the rim, which, everybody knows about. Everybody goes up there when they're young. And spent a lot of time in Sedona, and you go up there and, my dad taught me how to fish, and we'd go up there and bait fish with power bait and corn and whatever, man. And it was just so much fun.
Yeah.
And I think, once I actually started getting into the fly fishing side, and, there's a really good book called, Trout Streams and Their Hatches for Arizona. I think it's co-written by John Romer, and there was another gentleman, and I can't remember his name offhand.
What's it called? Trout Streams?
It's called Trout Streams and Their Hatches.
Oh, okay.
Really super good guidebook to fly fishing Arizona. And there's another one as well. I believe it's called Fly Fishing Arizona. Again, I could be wrong. I should have had this prepared and I wasn't. So I'm sorry about
that. We're going to have to start over.
I know. So there was the Trout Streams and Their Hatches, and just reading through that book, and I wasn't necessarily interested in the hatch part. I'm not going to lie, in terms of entomology and being a fly fisherman, I'm absolutely awful. I have a handful of patterns at work no matter where you go, and that's good enough for me. Unless I can't catch fish, then that's different. That book kind of opened me up to a lot of Arizona, especially places like the White Mountains, where we've got over 1,000 miles of trout streams in the White Mountains. And it's endless water to fish. I mean, you could fish there every single day for the next 5 years and not fish the same spot.
Wow. That's cool, man. Is that far away from you or?
It's up in northeastern Arizona. So to give you an idea, if you know where Sunrise Ski Resort is, or like Sholo, Pine Top, it's up in the White Mountains area. So basically northeastern Arizona. It's about anywhere from 4 hours to 5 hours from me.
Okay. So are they day trips? Are you doing overnight usually?
We do a lot of day trips up there in the summer, which is rough, man. Like we get up 2 a.m. We're out the door by 2:45, getting home at midnight, which is fine with me. I mean, that's what you got to do, right? Like we're not blessed like some other states are where you can fish the ditch 15 minutes from the house,
I just moved so I could do exactly what you're talking about on the Weber River. Because I can relate. I spent most of my life, at least after I left Colorado.
Yeah.
It was 4 hours, or more to the trout stream. But I did it when I was in Vegas also. Very hot.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. I drove up to Southwest Utah.
Okay.
And I fished the Sevier and a couple creeks up there. Yeah. It's great. But it was getting up driving 4 hours.
Yeah.
Fishing 8 hours, driving. I mean, it's a long day.
Dude, that's so cool that you are out in that area, man.
We're kindred spirits.
We are. We are. Dude, Utah is so rad to fish. Anyways, I'm getting off the subject. There's so many cool memories I have of Utah. Just same thing, dude. Just driving home, and we just decide to pull over and fish this random creek or this random bit of water, and you're just slaying fish, and you're like, oh, I can't find any information on it, but it's full of fish.
Yeah. Yeah, it was fun. That was a good time in my fly fishing life. And to be honest, like even though I was making that long drive, that I was fishing a lot.
Yeah.
Because I kind of had finally been stationed somewhere where I could be at least it was doable. Even though it was tough, it was doable. So all right, so you're driving a long ways up there, you're doing day trips. What else makes that special for you? Is it because of the adventure, or what else makes those rivers and those streams special for you?
Well, and I mean, we don't have to drive that far. I mean, we can drive up to the rim and be an hour and a half, 2 hours. What's special about the White Mountains in that particular area is, like you know, it's the adventure. There's just so many places. There's so many roads. There's so much water. Plus it's home to the Apache trout, which is the only place in the world you can find it. And then we have, you know, the Gila trout on quite a few of our creeks here now, which is, you know, only in Arizona and New Mexico. And I think not only did Arizona Game and Fish do a good job promoting Arizona and what Arizona has to offer from the fishing side, but also companies like Western Native Trout, man, like I feel like between them and Game and Fish and, you know, these different places who promoted having these special species that we have in Arizona, on top of the local community that we've put together here between all of us guys who fly fish, have helped kind of build this knowledge base for everybody else going, okay, well, Arizona is not just the Western state. It's just dry with no water. Like it's incredible. And we have incredible fish, but dude, you got to work for it, man. Like if you want to come here and be successful, I mean, you think you're a good fly fisherman if you live in Montana, cause you can catch fish, come here and we'll absolutely test your skills.
Okay. That sounds fair and reasonable. And, I think that is pretty cool that, because like I said, certainly it wasn't in my cross check when I was out there. Can you think of a time when you were fishing up there that you had a breakthrough moment or a time where you learned something fishing for these awesome trout that you're talking about with the Apaches? You learned something, it was kind of like a light bulb moment where it really helped you progress or get over a hump as a fly fisher.
Dude, I think it was just, I mean, I didn't realize how special those types of fish were, what kind of water it was when I first started fly fishing. It was reading books. And then once I started going to these places that the books talked about and you realize that they're pretty accurate, you know, then you start diving in a little bit more. It's just like research before any sort of trip, whether it's on your home waters or you're going out of state, right? Like you might start looking up clues and looking up blue lines and then you're like, okay, well, what's that? And then you're finding PDF reports from the 40s, 50s, and 60s of what used to be in there. And then you find these other, and then you go down like this dark hole of all this research that you've just done. I think the light bulb moment was for me, you know, being able to help a lot of my friends who a lot of them are a lot better fly fishers than I was, fly fishermen, but I had the knowledge. I'm really good at reading water. I was really good at doing research. So I was always taking us and myself to new spots. And we're realizing, dude, like when we go out and find these spots, like we're being successful. We're finding fish. We're finding fish nobody knew about. We're finding fish Game and Fish didn't even realize were there, or like what type of fish. Like that's cool to me, man, is going to places that, you know, nobody messes with, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Read a book. I mean, it's forgotten. It's the forgotten resource. Read a book, man. And I think that's cool. Yeah. I had a similar experience in Colorado. Well, you know, I bought the Fly Fisher's Guide to Colorado when I was probably 18 years old. It's a great book. It's a great book. And like you said, I still have a lot of streams in Colorado that are on the bucket list. I didn't get to all of them, but you know, they're pretty accurate if you know, so you can get out there. And I think that's awesome advice. You don't hear it very often, but I think it's certainly valuable.
Yeah.
If you could only fish up in the White Mountains 2 days out of the year, which 2 days would you fish it and why? Or how would you fish it?
Oh, dude.
So you could only make 2 trips up there. Which days of the year?
Wow, that's a tough one. So I would definitely say, I would say early September. I don't know which days. The 2 days would definitely be probably the first or second week in September.
Okay.
Only because at that time, the leaves start changing. A lot of especially the bigger browns start to get a little more active, but the weather's still nice enough and there's typically still enough bugs out where you could go up and hit most streams up there with dry flies.
Okay. Which
I love dry fly fishing, man. Like I could catch 5-inch fish all day long on a dry fly and be perfectly content.
Good for you. So Which dry fly are you putting on?
Dude, it depends, man. We have one here. Another guy who I followed a lot when I first started fly fishing, his name is Ben Smith, and he had a blog on his website. You know, a lot of it had to do with Arizona fishing and just Arizona in general. And he had this pattern called the mini hopper, which is, it's his fly. I'm sure he took some of the ideas from something else. I'm not quite sure. Yeah. But the Arizona mini hopper and dude, just an elk hair caddis, or even like little beetles, man. Beetles and ants here crush it. Like just, terrestrials. Just little foam terrestrials, man. Nothing big, size 12, size 14, all day long.
All right. What about the second day? So they don't have to be back-to-back days. Okay. You get two different days.
Oh, you're going to split it up?
You can do 2 days in a row. If you can do 2 days in a row if you really, really like that, or you could do another day.
I think the other one, you know, and it really, that depends on what kind of moisture Arizona gets throughout the winter because it's super unpredictable.
Yeah.
But fishing high water in Arizona on a lot of streams is super productive for big fish. I mean, a lot of people don't realize, one, that we have a lot of trout here, which obviously you did not either, and you lived here. But we've got some yeah. we've got some big fish, man, and they're super hard to catch, period. But you come that high water time, water's a little off color, a lot of food flowing, and there's a pretty good shot if you go to the right place and use the right fly, man, you're gonna get into a monster fish.
What time of the year is that?
That could, that could range anywhere. So if it's up on the rim, that could range anywhere from early March into late March, early April. If you're looking at the White Mountains, I mean, that could be as early as, you know, late April, early May into June.
Spring, early summer. Yeah.
Yeah.
I had some days up in Utah where it got a little bit too much rain or a little bit too much. No. Is there a balance there or, you know, because it seemed like in that area, at least where I was, that, you know, it would just be
roaring, you
know, chocolate mess or the typical chocolate mess. You run into that very often? Or I've also heard that the water clears up pretty quickly, though. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, you can get into that chocolate mess in the White Mountains for sure. There's a lot of snow. You have Sunrise Peak there. All the water up there for the most part is fed from Mount Baldy. So all the springs run into the black and the white and everything surrounding. So if you get a bunch of rain and it's blown out, man, I mean, you might as well just call it a day and go sip a beer somewhere. But on the rim, it's not nearly as bad. I mean, if you get a bunch of rain, I mean, everything floods, but you wait 2 or 3 days and it typically comes down to manageable.
All right. Can you talk to me about something you recently learned or maybe relearned with fishing in Arizona?
That I don't know shit. So when you go, there's quite a few places
that's weird. I learned that like every time I go,
every single trip.
Yeah.
There's quite a few places we go here where, you know, we could have the best day of fishing of our lives.
Yeah.
And you could literally come back the next day and get your ass handed to you and you don't catch a fish. You don't see, you'd swear that there was zero fish in anywhere.
Right.
Period. So I think that's a good humbling experience when you can go knowing your waters, knowing what you should throw, knowing the area and still get skunked. I actually love that because it keeps you humble. It makes you realize you should keep learning, especially when you're surrounded by people who are more adamant about you with changing your flies and changing colors and tactics and different things. I am not that guy, but luckily I have friends that do that and keep me in check. So
yeah. Getting skunked is part of the deal, I guess. You go with your friends quite often, or is that part of fly fishing that you really enjoy as well? I know we talked a little bit about it before the show, but you can talk about that aspect of fly fishing.
Yeah, when I first started fishing, you know, I fished with my buddy Aaron, who I was working with at the time. He's kind of the one that helped propel me into fly fishing. You know, I bought the setup, I went a couple of times and it kind of sat, and then he was really into it. He just moved in from Washington. Him and I fished a lot together. And then I met my buddy Josh, who's, I'm sure you've seen him on Instagram. His Instagram handle's Bag of Noodles. cracks me up every time I hear it or say it. You know, from that point on, when him and I met randomly from Instagram, where I've met a lot of my friends now who fly fish, which is really cool, man, that something that can be so toxic on one end can be so great on the other end that can connect you with all these people. But him and I fished hard. I mean, we still do, just not as much because we have life. But I think fishing with him and then meeting some of my other buddies, you know, my buddy Nate, my buddy Kyle, like we just, you know, my buddy Brent, we all try to go when we can together. or, you know, if only two of us can go. I like sharing that experience with somebody else, having that company. I mean, fly fishing by yourself is cool. It's really rewarding. It's good for your soul to get out. But I really appreciate the company, and I love, you know, being there for somebody's big fish or somebody's first or somebody's, you know, like you said, that light bulb moment when they're like, man, you know, whatever that might be. Like, I like that experience of sharing that.
Yeah, that is cool. There's two kind of different parts of it. Like you said, it's cool to be by yourself, but it's fun to be with others too, I think. And I think it's also nice to mentor and be mentored, or, you know, have someone to help you or someone that knows a little bit more when you go. I know for me, when I was starting out, that was a big part of it, a big reason, probably why I stuck with it, probably why I kept going, because I felt like I was making progress, I guess, because I had someone to help me and also to kind of like be a little bit of a barometer, you know? Like,
yeah.
If I was catching zero fish and, you know, Captain Haney wasn't catching fish or my buddy Steve wasn't catching fish, like, I knew, okay,
it's not you. Just me.
Yeah. this guy's pretty darn good at fly fishing. So, or maybe he's only catching a few fish today. So
yeah.
Have you had any of those types of experiences, or do you have a mentor or somebody that has helped you along the way?
Dude, that's a great point that you brought up. And yeah, man, my buddy Aaron and my buddy Josh, I mean, Aaron, I tied my first flies with him. He kind of gave me the rundown of fly fishing. And then, you know, when I met Josh, he always knows more about fly fishing than me in every aspect, whether it's the line, the type of fly, like, you know, maybe these certain tactics. And I think that's cool because I constantly learn from him, and it makes me feel good when I go out and maybe I'm using his flies or something he told me, or, you know, whatever, something he showed me when he was there, 'cause I wasn't catching anything.
Right.
And, you know, you start to be successful with it. And I think, you know, like you said, it's important to have somebody around to help you, and vice versa, because, you know, if you're not constantly learning when you're fly fishing or doing anything that you're passionate about, right?
Right.
What's the point of doing it? Like, you might as well just go do something else that, you know, you want to keep getting better at and learning from. Like, nobody's an expert in probably most fields.
Go drink a beer somewhere.
Lots of people are experts at that. We can pick that up real quick.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's cool. And I you know, it's cool also as you progress to kind of like help others too. Mm-hmm. And know that you can still learn from them as well. So you mentioned that you tie flies a little bit. I'm curious, did you get into tying flies at the same time, or did that come after? Why'd you start? And then I got to ask you, give me some beginner type flies that I could tie that when I come out there.
Sure. Dude, so I hope when I send this to my buddies, they listen to it, because I have tied flies maybe half a dozen times in the last like 2.5 years between you and me. Okay. So they're going to listen to this and be like, he doesn't tie flies, but you might even get some messages and it's going to be hilarious. So I started tying flies basically at the same time. I bought a cheap mongoose vise, which I still have, and it's still amazing. I don't care what anybody says. It's a great vise.
Okay.
Started doing it at the same time. My buddy Aaron he taught me how to tie my first streamers, which I still have. And I was really successful on them on a trip this year, which was awesome because I blew the dust off them. They haven't seen the light of day in like 5 years. I started doing it at the same time, man. I just thought that was a part of fly fishing, right? Like, you wanted to tie the bugs that you saw, or maybe flies that somebody else is successful with. I mean, buying flies is cool, but it just adds to the experience to be able to sit down, tie your own fly, figure it out. I mean, it's like fly fishing in that sense, where, you know, you have a place that you need to start, and you have a spot that you need to get to, or some sort of, you know, way you want to progress. And tying flies is like that. You're like, oh man, I really want elk hair caddis, or I want this little beetle. And you go out and then you're successful on your own flies, and it makes it that much more rewarding.
Right. And like you said too earlier, you know, read a book. So
read a book.
You read the book, you do some research, and then you're like, okay, I'm going to tie these flies that I read about. And you kind of like, it is a exercise in do it yourself that is highly rewarding, I think. So I think that's cool. I think it's cool that you stumbled upon it early on too, because I didn't tie flies for a long time.
Really?
Yeah. I mean,
Did you have any interest, or was it just like you were like, oh, I can just go buy them at the store for a dollar a piece?
I think it was, I didn't have any interest, to That's be quite fair. Honest with you. That's I didn't fair. Think I had any interest in it whatsoever. I just was like, it's just, I don't have time for that. I'm not too busy or something. And my wife got me a fly tying kit for Christmas when I was getting really into it when we were in Vegas.
That's awesome.
I don't recommend a kit for people. I wrote a whole blog post about buy a fly tying kit.
Yeah.
But if it gets you started in fly fishing, I guess it's okay. But I wish I had done things differently, but and then I did a trip up with one of my friends that I worked with in Vegas, and he's a passionate angler as well. And I caught my first fish on a size 12 olive beadhead hares ear.
Nice. And
this is big, it was a big, like, starting out fly. Like, okay. I can't handle the small hook, so big hook. And I caught like three fish in this little section. Hadn't been catching fish all day. And that is when I got hooked on tying. Well, I mean, that's when I really got into tying and started to really get more into it. I think, in my opinion, the best way to start and keep tying flies is to start catching fish with the flies that you tie. That'll motivate you.
Oh, for sure.
That's why I don't like a kit, because I think there's so many patterns that you tie that you might not use. Maybe they're trying to teach you skill sets or whatever, but which is good and important. But when I was catching fish with the flies I would tie, even if it was only a couple patterns, that was it for me. I'm like, this is a whole, just like you said.
Yeah.
It's a different part of the experience. Mm-hmm. And then you start to want to do better at it. Like you said, progress and it becomes part of it. So.
Yeah. And I've only gotten a few patterns down, man. And I've realized that, you know, you don't even have to be good at tying flies. Like, the uglier the fly, the better it's going to work.
Yeah. A lot of times, for sure. Yeah. I mean, there's a reason why, you know, you start catching fish and the fly gets ate up, or, you know, it's falling apart. And sometimes those flies work good too. So
they still catch fish.
They do. Yeah. I think it's cool to tie really awesome, pretty flies as well.
Yeah.
I think it's a different thing that you're doing, but I guess if they catch fish, then they're equally good, I guess, you know?
Well, that's a whole nother art form, man. Like you said, that's something I don't have time for. Like, I can't sit down and spend 2 hours on one fly. Like, I'm not that crafty.
Well, the other thing is I'm actually surprised to hear you say that you had those streamers you tied and they lasted that long. Like, my flies, they're gone.
I lose so many. Long because I hadn't used them.
Oh,
they
okay.
were brand new. I caught probably two or three or four fish, dude, and they were done. They're falling apart. The legs were gone.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't get deep into head cement early enough in my fly tying career.
Yeah. Or super glue. That's a good thing for a beginning fly tire. Don't be afraid to use some head cement or super glue.
Dab it on there. I also I recently in the last several years I started using the UV stuff, and that works really good. I think that really seals it down pretty good with the flashlight and all that,
and it looks cool, especially if you do it right.
If you do it right, it looks really cool.
If you're making a Christmas ornament, not so much. It's not gonna fish well.
Anything else you want to share about some of the waters out there in Arizona before I start asking you about this epic, and I don't use the word epic lightly, backpacking trip into the Sierras?
No, man, we could probably drag on about that all day, but no, we can go to the Sierras.
All right, let's go to the Sierras. So why did you guys do the trip? What was the catalyst for going into the Sierras?
So we had done a few backpacking trips up there, nothing extensive, just a couple of days to go up there and chase golden trout. Cause you know, that's something have you ever chased golden trout?
No, I just had a guest on the other day who shamed me because when I was in Montana, I did a lot of. You're going to shame me. That's okay. You're
no, not at all. Too. Not at all.
When I was in Montana, we used to do a lot of backpacking. Not a lot, but we did a fair amount of backpacking up into the Beartooth. And there's some lakes up there that we're told had goldens in them. And we just too hard. We'll just skip them, you know, go to these other ones, which the other ones were pretty hard to get to as well.
Sure.
So I don't know what it would have been like for 16, 17 year old Jason, who was in pretty damn good shape.
It probably would have been epic.
Oh my gosh. Epic quotes. I remember getting up to some of these lakes, and I mean, like I said, I was in really good shape. I was an athlete in high school, but I would walk like 50 yards and sit down to catch my breath. I mean, we were just so high up, I think, that we were beat. We were beat. So, long answer to No, I haven't.
Dude, so golden trout, man, there's something else. I remember the first time we went up to that same area, and we went up to, and people might say I'm spot burning, I'm not. It's called Cottonwood Lakes. It's a pretty common area if you look up golden trout. Like, it's a pretty common area. It does take a little bit of a hike to get into, but golden trout are just so beautiful, man. Like, you catch, especially if the sun's out and they're hitting dries. I mean, the sun hits them a certain way and you just see this yellow and red, and it's just, it's pretty ridiculous. But anyways, sorry, that was the reason for this trip was there was some spots up in the mountains in the Sierras my buddy Jordan had been to, but it's been a while. His first experience there was not the greatest. It was really rushed. He didn't get to fish the way he wanted to. So a lot of the places we stopped along the way were places that he wanted to get back to and explore. So that was kind of the catalyst for that particular trip was, you know, he invited us to come along, my buddy Josh and I, and he kind of had out where he wanted to go and the places he wanted to do. And obviously we gave our input as well, like what we thought. And that's what it was, man. It was just a trip for the three of us to get out and have a super proper, not rushed backpacking trip where, you know, your main focus was the backcountry. You didn't have to worry about anything. You didn't have to worry about people or like what were, you know, we had a route, we did the route, and it was incredible.
Yeah. Sounds awesome. And it was, how many days were you back there?
So we were back there. I can't remember if it was Tuesday to Tuesday or Tuesday to Wednesday. I think it was Tuesday to Tuesday. So we got up really early. I believe it was Tuesday morning. Josh and I drove up to Lone Pine. We went up to the top of Cottonwood Trailhead and we stayed the night there. We kind of acclimated a little bit because I think Cottonwood, that area up there, is about 10,000 feet. The highest we would hit this trip is just under 13,000, like just under 13,000. So we did that. And then the next morning we got up pretty darn early and we started hiking Wednesday morning, super early. And we ended up hiking out from the top of Shepherd's Pass, Tuesday morning, the following Tuesday morning, which was gnarly, dude. Like, Shepherd's Pass is exactly at 10,000 feet. And I think it's a 5,000 or 6,000 foot descent to the bottom. And it is a knee grinder. Like, it just doesn't end. Like, you think when you look down Shepherd's Pass, you're like, oh, the car's down there somewhere. And then you get down and you go this way and then you go this other way. And then you're like, oh, cool, we're almost there. And 4 hours later, you're still hiking.
Yeah. How was the weather for you guys? What was the weather in the mountains changes a lot. It's one thing I remember. What was the best weather and the worst weather experience for you?
So we definitely planned for the worst in some senses. I mean, we had all our rain gear ready. We're ready to rock. And every single day we were up there, we had the most beautiful bluebird skies every single day. We had a little bit of wind in the middle of our trip. And one evening we had a couple of sprinkles off and on. But for some reason, the little bowl that we were in the whole time, when there was storms around us, would not come up into the bowl because we were at a pretty high pass.
Yeah.
You could hear down, like, you know, kind of where the John Muir Trail was off this bowl. It was storming and you could hear thunder and we got nothing. And it was absolutely incredible. The whole trip.
Good for you, man. I think I got rained on every time I went in the mountains or snowed. Really? I got snowed on one time and I almost died. But, but that's because we tried to hike out while it was snowing. But
that's a little sketch. That was probably a learning moment.
Yeah, that was like, a big learning moment. Yeah. How did you guys fish it? Was it all lake fishing? Were you fishing streams or what was that geography like?
So the majority of it was still water, which, you know, anybody who knows me closely, I would much rather fish a tiny creek or a stream all day long.
I'm very similar. Yeah. I like the moving water.
Yeah. And like you yourself, you're constantly moving, right? Like you're not sitting in one spot looking at the same scenery, which there's nothing wrong with that, man. Like I'm not knocking on anybody else who wants to do that, but I like to get out and hike and move and see new water and new fish. And, but yeah, so it was mostly still water. It was a lot of lakes. And then there was a few creeks we fished in between, which some of the streams up in the Eastern Sierras, man, are ridiculous. They're crystal clear, absolutely loaded with fish.
Yeah.
No problem catching fish. I mean, you could be on top of fish catching fish. No problem. They weren't spooky.
Yeah. Which flies were you using? Were you dry fly fishing mostly, I guess?
We were mostly dry fly fishing in the creeks. That's all you had to do, man. Like golden trout are a lot like cutthroat in that sense. They're always looking up. So if you get them on a creek, I mean, if you go up there with literally anything that floats, they're going to eat it. It doesn't matter what it is. It doesn't matter how big it is. Like they're going to try to eat it. Most of the ones we're catching in the stream are pretty small. But when we got to the lakes, man, to be honest, the go-tos were semi-seal leeches.
Really? I mean,
that's kind of my go-to period, man. Like if I was to have one fly for the rest of my life, it'd be a semi-seal leech, hands down.
Leech. Okay. And so how are you fishing that? Are you stripping it? Are you like in a lake? What are you doing with it?
So in a lake, you can throw it under a bobber if you want to. Like bobber fishing's not my favorite, unless I have to. But typically, yeah, you just slow strip it. You slow strip it, whether it's on sink tip or sinking line or hopefully floating line, so you don't have to mess with all that. It's really good for cruising fish, you know, especially cutthroat, man. Cutthroat love leeches. Among other things, but yeah, so we didn't get a lot of cruisers that trip, but a lot of it was just, you know, it was that time of year where these lakes are pretty deep. The fish were mostly deep. So just slow stripping streamers.
All right. I thought I would do a section of the podcast where it's time for Anthony to do story time. So
okay.
I get the impression from some of the stuff that you posted about the trip that you caught a fairly decent amount of different species of fish. Is that right? Would it be accurate
for California?
For the, where you were in the mountains, you caught multiple species, right?
No, it was just golden trout.
Just golden?
Just goldens. So that's all right. There's been a lot of other trips where we go, where we catch other species. We had another species planned for this trip, but our last night there, we got to Shepherd's Pass a little bit late. Okay. There was a gnarly storm rolling in that we weren't sure was going to hit, and it happened to hit on that side. So we didn't go there, but yeah, it was just golden trout.
That's all right. I've got a plan for this.
Okay. Good.
What was the most memorable fish of the trip for you and for your friends?
Oh dude, that's a great question.
And why?
Dude, if I'm completely honest, I don't have like a most memorable catch that trip. I think one of the coolest was when we got to these one lakes. Well, this one lake, it wasn't lakes. It was a lake. We came up this gnarly pass, came down the gnarly pass, which was pretty crazy coming down. It was so steep and loose rock, and you can see the lake way off in the distance. It looked really close, and it was not that close. And we got there and we kind of laid, you know, the water was a little bit lower this year. So we had like this huge beach to ourselves. So there's a lake there. You had the beach and we just camped right there. It was like an Eastern Sierra, you know, high alpine beach, and it was incredible. And we dropped all our crap and just immediately started fishing because we were exhausted. We were whatever. And, there was a couple of fish that were rising, and you know, I was the first one to put on a dry fly, and I kept seeing this fish rise, and I tossed this dry fly out, and this dude had to have been out 45, 50 feet. Like I have no idea how I whipped my little 4-weight dry fly rod out that far. I managed to, and he ate, and that was the first fish of that lake. It was one of the lakes we stayed overnight at where we didn't have to immediately hike the next day, where we had all day to fish. I think that was definitely the most memorable fish for me. Of that trip for sure.
Awesome. You talked about, you know, some of the lakes you stayed longer than others. Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask you a little bit about some of the logistics of planning a trip like that. I know you said your friend planned a lot of it, but any kind of lessons learned that you have that stick out immediately that like, I wish we had thought about this or done this, or I'm glad we did that for planning a trip like that. Eight days in the Sierras, or 7 days?
Dude, I think it's just, And to be honest, it was honestly executed pretty well. I mean, the way we had planned it out, laid it out, the way Jordan had kind of put the days together of where we were going to stay. I mean, we had to change plans a little bit, but it was very minor. It's just, I think it's making a plan and sticking to it and knowing where you want to be on what day, what time of day, knowing, hey, I have a 9-hour hike the next day, to make sure you give yourself enough time. Cause we never got caught being somewhere where we didn't expect to be, or, you know, we didn't put ourselves in any situations where, you know, we're not going to make it to our destination or we're going to get lost, you know, whatever it might be. Figuring out when you're going to rest. Like, I think that's important on a trip that lengthy. I mean, we had two overnight stays where we had, you know, we got to the lake that afternoon, that evening, stayed the whole next day and then hiked out the next morning. I think that was really helpful. I think we ended up doing about 84 miles in total over that 7.5 days.
That's no joke.
No, not at all. So it was about, I mean, it was a good 5.5 days of mostly hiking with a little bit of fishing in between, with, you know, those two solid days of fishing. But I think, yeah, man, anybody doing it, I think it's just making sure, you know where you're going, you have a plan, people know where you're going, where you're going in, where you're coming out, when to expect you. Garmin inReaches are an amazing tool for back home or whoever that you need to check in with. And just being prepared, man, being prepared. Like, if you know you're going someplace that you can't catch and keep fish, like, make sure you have enough food. That's always important.
Let's talk about that. What kind of equipment are you glad that you had? Anything that you maybe didn't need, or, you know, how'd you pack for it as far as the essentials or, that type of thing?
So I think at the end of the trip, Josh and I had packed just enough, like literally just enough. I think him and I both pretty much ran out of food that evening before we hiked out of Shepherd's Pass. I think we each had a snack that next morning. So somehow we ended up doing okay in that sense, but we'd also planned along the way. There was a couple places where you could keep fish. So we had each brought like a good sized pack of tortillas and some different things where, you know, we could catch some fish and eat some fish tacos.
Yeah.
Which, if you've never had fish tacos in the backcountry, man, like after hiking or whatever, just having that nice hot, fresh meal is like, it's life changing. Like, you don't realize how good it is until you're sitting down and eating it.
Yeah. I've never had fish taco, but I have had fish in the backcountry and it's pretty cool. It's, I think it was probably wasted on me as a youth. That's pretty good. Anything that you brought that you were like, oh, I don't need this?
Probably my 6.5-pound tent. I think it would have been smart. I had an old Mountain Hardware tent that I've been backpacking with forever. And then I see, you know, Josh and Jordan's tent, and they're pretty small, and they're like 3 pounds, and I'm lugging around this big ass tent. So I think, you know, with something like that, like, weight is key. And especially when it comes to something like, you know, your tent and your sleeping bag, especially if you're going to a time where you need a bag, having a lighter tent would have been great. Having a little bit bigger of a backpack would have been great. I think it's one of those things. It's like anything, man. It's like fly fishing. Like, you learn by doing it, right? Like, you go out and do a few trips and go, okay, well, you know, I wish I'd have had this or didn't have this. You know, I've been backpacking a long time. So is Jordan. Josh is pretty new to it, but he had us to ask questions. So we pretty much had, I mean, a jet boil is an amazing tool. I think everybody should get a jet boil.
Talk to me about what a jet boil is.
So jet boil is just, you know, it's, some people find it unnecessary. I think it's phenomenal. It's a big 32-ounce cup that straps on top of a little stove. And you have these little things of fuel that you bring with you.
Yeah.
And you can screw it right on there and you can boil water. If you need water to drink, you need water for food, you want to make oatmeal, you want to make coffee. Like, it's kind of.
Yeah. A little Coleman stuff. We used to have a little Coleman stuff. Yeah. But it sounds much better. And it's a jet. A jet is better than Coleman stuff.
Dude, so. And it boils so fast. Like, I used to use an old MSR stove, man. You hook it up to white gas and you try to boil something, and 50 minutes later, you finally got a few bubbles in the water. this thing, even at 11,000 feet would boil water in, you know, 4 minutes, 5 minutes.
That's
no
cool.
problem.
I hope my friend is listening to this, I'm going to have him listen to it, because when we got stuck in the snow, part of the reason we were hungry. And so we're in the tent, we're getting wet, you know. I was in the middle, they're on the outside, so they're getting more wet than me, so they're more motivated to go. I'm gonna stick to my story that I was the only one that was like, let's not leave. Let's not get out of here. They're like, no, we're leaving. But anyway, we had macaroni and cheese, and we're just staring at this water, waiting for it to boil, waiting. And finally, like, it'll be fine, man. Put the macaroni and cheese in. It was not fine. It was so terrible. It might have been the straw that broke the camel's back. On the rock slide with snow and stuff.
Yeah. But you're like, just kill me now.
Yeah. All right, Anthony. So this trip into the Sierras was pretty much for golden trout. Those were most of the fish you're catching, or all the fish, I guess. But I know that you enjoy fishing for all different types of species, and you've been on multiple backpacking trips. It's part of what you like to do it's part of what you enjoy about fly fishing. Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask you about some of your more memorable stories from all the different species of fish that you've kind of caught. And I guess we can start with grayling. Can you tell us the most memorable grayling story that you have in your adventures?
Yeah, absolutely. So it was most recently, I was lucky enough to be affiliated with this company, Trestle, and they set up my buddy Jeff and I with the Mile High 25, which was put on in Colorado by Anglers All Fly Shop.
Okay.
And Jeff and I, that was one of the fish on our list because it was worth quite a few points. So basically the point of that tournament was to catch fish. Depending on the species you caught, you got a certain amount of points, and that's kind of how you ranked up, so to speak.
So it was like a fly fishing competition kind of thing? Like a beer of the world kind of club thing?
Basically, yeah. So it's a fly fishing tournament that they put on every year, and you have these teams of two. And you go out, and it's all over Colorado. It doesn't matter where, and you just try to catch all these different species of fish, whether it's warm water, cold water. Where you decide to fish and what you want to do with your time is totally up to you. Cool. You obviously have to be really efficient with it, or else you're not going to do well. You're just going to do a lot of driving. So we ended up not realizing how long it was going to actually take to go chase these grayling. So we spent almost a full day. It was about 4.5 hour drive up. Once we got to this super gnarly Jeep road, it was probably an hour and 40 minutes up this Jeep road. I don't know. It was a long ways just to get to the top. We park, we hike, everything looks great. It's a beautiful day. We hike all the way back to the lake, and the damn lake is completely frozen over. So we're kind of walking around, and we're like, all right. And we passed a little bit of water on the way up, and we're just defeated at this point. Cause we're like, man, like we just blew a whole day chasing this one species of fish. And we popped back down to this other little lake that was below this other one and didn't really have any luck there. The water was kind of funky looking. And we ended up seeing these like ponds on the way out. And I happened to spook some fish while we were walking through these ponds. And I'm like, dude, and I just hollered at him. I'm like, dude, fish. And and then I'm trying to catch these fish with the stupidest fly ever. I was just excited to see fish. Like I was just pumped because we were on this mountain and like we were defeated. And then he hollers at me and he's hooked up to this super nice grayling. I mean, this grayling was probably pushing a little over 16 inches. So I haul ass over to him and he's just catching grayling on dries, like these big grayling dudes. So I throw on a dry and first cast, I mean, this big sail comes up out of the water and sips this dry fly.
Oh, that's cool, man.
And it was only about 20 minutes. Like we could have stayed there all day and we were just one after the other, man, grayling that were ranging from, 6-7 inches, but most of them were 14, 16, almost 17 inches. And it was so damn cool because I did not expect to catch a grayling that size anywhere, period, but especially not there.
Yeah. Rio Grande cutthroat.
Rio Grandes. That's another special fish. So my buddy Nate, he was the one originally kind of found out about this place through a little bit of research and something he had heard. And we had taken a trip to Colorado. It was me and my buddy Josh and him. Our other buddy Kyle unfortunately couldn't make it. And we drive up, and we have to camp down at the bottom because it's still, you know, probably a 6 mile hike up to where the lakes are. And dude, same thing with that trip, man. Like there's a stream that runs down that has Rio Grande. So we got there, immediately started crushing beers. and went to the creek and started catching fish. The water was really high, so it was tough to fish. But we each managed a few fish, and Rio Grandes are stunning fish, man. Like they're absolutely beautiful. So we spent the afternoon and evening doing that, went back, got up really early the next morning, took a pretty gnarly hike up. Gnarly in the sense of it was lengthy. And once we got up to the top of the mountain, it was still covered in snow. So we're hiking through like knee deep of snow, unexpected. Yeah. And same thing, man, we hiked up and we're getting really excited. And then we start seeing more snow and more snow. And then came around the corner where the damn lake is and it's frozen. So we walk up to the lake as we're all just kind of pissing and moaning out loud as you do when that happens. And there was just a tiny, tiny bit of open water. So we spent most of the morning and afternoon just fishing this open water. And my buddy Josh was the first one to hook up on a fish after I had missed one. So I guess technically I was. And dude, we each caught a Rio Grande that was, you know, 20, 21, 22 inches. And we were throwing, my buddy Pete ties up these things called the after dinner midge. Okay. And I ended up throwing that on an indicator, which I hate doing, man, but we only had like 4 feet of water to fish, right? Like it was the ice that was the only deep shelf. So we just put it out there and almost immediately, man, we started catching some fish, and it was, I can't believe how pretty those fish are, man. Like those high alpine cutthroat, you know, it doesn't really matter the species. They're just absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah. Cutthroat is my favorite species of trout to catch, mostly because I have a lot of memories tied to that fish from when I was a kid in Montana. Okay. With my father and stuff. But now that I'm in Utah, I'm learning about a lot of the different types of species.
And yeah.
I caught a Bonneville cutthroat the other day, and I just didn't know what I had gotten into. I'm like, oh my gosh, it's just rose cheeks.
And, yeah.
I didn't really understand what I was getting into at first. I was like, this is a cutthroat, but it's not like any cutthroat I'd seen before. Yeah. And like, you know, yeah, Jason, there's more than one kind. So it's just a little different, but that's cool. All right. How about Apache and or Gila trout?
Sure. So we can knock off both those really quick. So Apache trout, I mean, they're found pretty sporadically through the White Mountains. There's a couple of populations there, especially on the reservation, the White Mountain Apache Reservation, that you can't fish for them. They're in protected waters. But we have a couple of streams there that are just loaded with them. I mean, Game and Fish does a really good job with, you know, going in and making sure that, you know, there's catchable fish. There's also wild populations. It's just a special fish, man. And I think anybody coming to Arizona, you know, should take the time to go up to the White Mountains. I mean, it's not a secret. There's a place called Sheep's Crossing on the Little Colorado River. There's wild fish as well as stocked fish. And, it's an easy spot to fish. I mean, you could bring your kids out there and hang out by the bridge and catch some stocked Apache trouts. And it's just, they're really cool, man. And I think the main appeal to that too, is they're found nowhere else in the world. Like this is the only place that you can find Apache trout, which is really cool.
Super cool. Is there a fish that you remember catching specifically, or maybe anything like that, or no?
I just think there's been a few memorable Apache trout I've caught. I think it's just when you explore certain waters tied to other waters, and you're going after something like brook trout or brown trout or vice versa. And, you know, there's been a couple of times where I've been on some of these streams where, you know, you're out chasing brown trout and then, you know, you catch a fish and you're like, well, what the hell is that? And you get it out and man, I've caught some of the prettiest little wild Apache trout that I had zero idea existed in that particular stream or that particular section of stream.
Yeah. And
I think that's always a really cool surprise.
Yeah. It's like a discovery.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, and then the Gila trout, man, the Gila trout, you know, we up until recently, Only had them at a place called Fry Creek up by Fry Mesa Reservoir, which is outside of Safford on Mount Graham. And unfortunately, it was hit by a really, really nasty fire on top of Mount Graham. Gila trout seem to be getting the bad end of the stick with that, man. Like every time there's a rehabilitation stream, something along those lines, like they get hit by a forest fire and just completely decimate the stream. This one is really detrimental enough so where Game and Fish worked with some other agencies to go, and they actually went up there and rescued. It was 100 and something fish with helicopters taking them off the mountain. And I think a lot of them went back to Mora Fish Hatchery to be stored, and some of them stayed here in Arizona so that they could redistribute them. But now Gila trout, they're starting to put a little bit more into some of the streams up on the rim where you can go up and catch them. They're not closed. And a couple of the rehabilitation streams have opened up in Prescott and the rim. And yeah, man, it's a beautiful species. Same thing, only found here in Mexico. Really unique fish. I mean, it's just, if you've never seen them or caught one, there's nothing like them.
Yeah. All right, Anthony, before I ask you my last question, how can people find out more about you, share in some of your adventures or any upcoming projects or maybe some cool trips that you have planned?
Just through my Instagram, which is at Into the Wild We Go.
Okay. And I know you mentioned before the show that you have a couple of backpacking trips in the works. What's going on with that?
So this next one, I think I'm really hoping we can put it together this year. I'm hoping it's going to be 7 to 10 days in the Wind River Range in Wyoming.
Cool. Yeah.
So that's going to be, I mean, the target of that trip is going to be, you know, basically big goldens. That's what a lot of the trout are known for in the Wind Rivers, but also we want to get into some good brook trout and cutthroat.
Yeah. I just talked to Dana Ostoff, and that's where she likes to go for goldens too. I was talking about how she shamed me and, that sounds like a cool place, man.
Yeah.
All right. Last question. You ready?
Yes, sir.
If you could go back to when you first started fly fishing and give yourself two pieces of advice, one more tactical and one more philosophical, what would you tell yourself to progress as a fly fisher?
I think from the tactical side that I think a lot of people have issues with this, and it's something, you know, learning to fly fish in Arizona is the importance of being stealthy and being quiet and knowing, you know, where your shadow is and how hard you're walking. And if you walk up to most streams, especially here, I mean, this is advice I gave people when I did guide and even people I might just be, you know, kind of teaching how to fly fish, is if you can see the fish, they can see you, right? So if you're constantly trying to sight fish and you're just out stomping around making a bunch of noise, like you're going to be really unsuccessful. And I think that's something I had a hard time with when I first started fly fishing, because I was just, you know, I was like a hound dog, man. Like I was just looking for fish, and that's all I wanted to do. I just wanted to see the fish and catch that fish. And I think that's why I was very unsuccessful when I first started fly fishing. And then I guess part two to that with the philosophical side is, you know, I would say slow down, take your time, you know, sit and look around once in a while. Like, don't just focus on the water and catching fish, you know, look at the trees, look at the sky, and just enjoy the peaceful, you know, the peaceful nature that you have around you, and just kind of take it all in. I think that just adds to the experience when you can appreciate every aspect of fly fishing and why you're actually there.
I think it does too. I think those are two good pieces of advice. Certainly worthy of helping people progress as fly fishers. So thanks for that. Thanks for taking the time. Thanks for being on the podcast. I've really enjoyed talking with you, Anthony, and I'm excited to see what you get into this coming year with your upcoming trips and backpacking and catching fish.
Yeah, man, dude. Thank you so much for having me on, Jason. It was really cool talking to you too. And hopefully this won't be the last conversation we have.
Thanks for listening to the Wade Out There Fly Fishing Podcast. You can learn more about some of the topics we discussed in today's episode show notes. For more fly fishing ideas, stories, and artwork, check out my blog and online gallery at wadeoutthere.com. If you want to make Wade Out There a part of your own fly fishing journey, please subscribe and share. Until next time, wade out there.